This is the time set for oral argument in LaFrance v. Klein, case number 76161. Before we get underway, I want to say that Justice Silver has recused herself. She participated in this case when it was before the Court of Appeals. Justice Stiglitz is not present today, but she will be participating and she will listen to the oral arguments. But you have in Carson City, Justice Kadish, Justice Hardesty, and Justice Perigary, and in Las Vegas, myself, Justice Pickering, and Justice Gibbons. So with the five of us and the two of you, we're ready to proceed. And please let us know if you want any time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve some 5 minutes at the end for rebuttal.
Very well.
Well, isn't he the respondent? Oh, that was Mr. Willick, huh? Okay.
Yes, there appears to be a last-minute technical problem on the video.
Got it. Thank you.
Do you think it's about that it can be readily resolved, or do you want to proceed?
We've been working on it, but your techs and mine were unable to figure out the cause, so I'm afraid I don't want to hold the court up any further than I have to.
Can you see the time clock?
I can.
Okay, good. So Mr. Willick is going to proceed for the appellants, and Ms. Mastel will proceed for the respondent, I believe.
No, Your Honor. Actually, Mr. Jones represents the respondent. Ms. Mastel is online as co-counsel and trial counsel for the appellant.
Okay. Are you and Ms. Mastel going to divide time, or are you proceeding, Mr. Willick, for both?
I'll be proceeding for the appellant's position entirely. Ms. Mastel is there for her support.
Very well. You may proceed, but please tell the clerk how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal. And we have allotted 40 minutes for this argument, so each side has 20 minutes.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
Very well.
Is he worth it?
Yes. It's Mr. Willick who's been talking.
Let me know when I can begin.
I'm sorry, we couldn't hear you.
I just need to know when I'm cleared to begin.
Mr. Willick, you may proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, Justices, Marshall Willick for Mary LaFrance, may it please the court. True equality requires an equal opportunity to choose, which was denied to these parties because the divorce complaint was filed before they were retroactively deemed married. At the time of the filing, there was no marriage, leading to a decision that committed three primary errors. First, it denied Mary the opportunity to prove that at all times the parties intended to and did hold their income and assets as separate property. Second, it summarily treated all of Mary's property acquired decades before she ever met Gail as the party's community property. And third, it treated joint tenancy property acquired with unequal contributions as community property. In all opposite sex cases since 1975, this court has applied the Braddock rule that the nature of property rights is determined by the laws of the state of domicile at the time the property is acquired. Resolution of this case could be as simple as applying that authority equally to same-sex couples. At the time all the property in question here was accrued, the law of the state of Nevada was that it was separate property until and unless the parties consciously chose to co-own it. There is no authority from anywhere that would deem as marital property everything owned by two people in a non-common law marriage state, despite their intention to keep that property separate. We have provided for comparison cases of same-sex couples who did live in common law marriage states, where the evidence showed that they intended to co-own all their property. Obergefell allows that intention to be given retroactive effect. Where the evidence shows that they did not intend to co-own all of their property, the property remains separate. Even where common law marriage is possible, it requires a showing that both parties intended to co-own their property and have all of the other incidents of marriage apply to them. The uncontroverted evidence in this case is that these parties intended to and did keep all of their property separate except for one asset, which they jointly titled. In Nevada, for parties who are not married at a given time to own community property by analogy or otherwise, they must, under Hay and Mitchoff, specifically intend to co-own that property in a joint venture or partnership. The question asked in all opposite sex cases is intent to accrue property together. The proof of what these parties intended is in what they did and what they did not do. They kept all their property separate. When domestic partnerships became available in Nevada in 2009, they did not register their Vermont civil union. They did not get a Nevada domestic partnership. In fact, they testified at the trial that, quote, we had our property titled exactly the way we wanted it. We had arranged everything the way we wanted it, and there was really nothing that a domestic partnership had to offer us. Both parties confirmed that they chose to not title anything jointly except the house, and they never considered or discussed doing anything different. Mary testified that the Vermont and Canadian ceremonies were strictly for political action. Gail admitted that she knew that. And both parties, who both had legal training, acknowledged that the ceremonies would have no legal effect in Nevada. They never filed joint taxes, adopted a common last name, combined or shared accounts, or did anything else indicating an intention to co-own property. If these parties had intended to co-own property as of the time of the Vermont Civil Union in 2000, there would have been no reason for the Canadian ceremony in 2004. And they would have registered the Vermont Civil Union in Nevada when it was legally possible to do so in 2009 to make all their property community property. But they didn't. Instead, they did everything necessary and legally possible for them to keep all of their property separate. Neither of them had any notice that anyone might think otherwise until the Lotta decision in 2014, at which time they were already in litigation. These parties demonstrated by their actions that they had an agreement as to how to hold their property. And this court said in Grisham that it will enforce such agreements if they are not unconscionable, illegal, or in violation of public policy. That is why this is an equal protection case. For opposite sex couples, this court has said repeatedly that it will protect parties, quote, reasonable expectations regarding their property rights. The Law Review article states that the same protection should be extended to same-sex couples, where a retroactive decision alters parties' reliance interests, court should apply remedies sufficient to protect those interests. At minimum, a district court must inquire whether the unique situation of being retroactively married is a compelling reason to unequally divide property that has been retroactively deemed community. Nevada abolished common law marriage, at least for opposite sex couples, in 1943. Equal protection requires that the legal effect of common law marriage should not be retroactively imposed on same-sex couples. In short, equal protection requires giving same-sex couples the same choices available to opposite-sex couples, taking into account their unique circumstances. Here, these parties have been treated differently than even other same-sex couples, strictly as a matter of timing. All same-sex couples prior to Lotta only had co-ownership of property if they consciously decided to do so and titled the property accordingly. And all same-sex couples after Obergefell have the same rights as any other couple to enter into a prenup or otherwise choose how their property will be treated. Only those who accrued property in a non-recognition state like Nevada and then broke up right at the time of Lotta are treated differently. Same-sex couples who are retroactively deemed married have the same right as opposite-sex couples in every annulment action to prove that despite the appearance of a marriage, their intentions and actions did not create legally binding marital relationship that creates community property. Family courts annul marriages all the time, for all kinds of reasons. If the parties entered into what looks like a marriage, for any reason other than to actually have all the incidents of a lawful marriage apply to them. And here, The uncontroverted evidence is that the union and marriage ceremonies were political actions, not intended to alter property rights. Whereas here, parties were not legally able to sign a premarital agreement or to do anything else that they did not, in fact, do to keep their property separate, the trial court is required as a matter of remedies under equal protection to determine the actual intent of the parties at all times prior to the Latta decision in 2014, because doing anything else treats them unequally under law. If Mary's spouse was named George instead of Gail, she would have had an opportunity to prove that intention. And even if it was possible and proper to retroactively characterize any of the parties' separate property at some point in time as community, the uncontroverted evidence was that Mary had over $1 million in separate property before the Vermont Civil Union. Gail admitted it on the stand. Mary testified to the sum of her pre-union assets, and Exhibit 5J is a summary of admitted evidence showing over $1 million in pre-union assets. There was no conflicting evidence. Alba says that the property award has to conform to a range possible under the evidence. It didn't. It was reversible error under Blanco and Walsh to treat Mary's separate property investments and retirement assets as community. If Mary had been named Larry, there's no way that the family court would have decided to give Gail half of the assets Mary accrued in the decades before the two of them ever met. Mary is entitled to equal protection of the law. The house held in joint tenancy should be decided in accordance with the contributions of the parties. That's the rule that this court has declared in all opposite sex cases, in Sack, in Langevin, in Howard, and in Pittman. There's no legitimate reason to treat these parties any differently. In conclusion, three holdings are appropriate here. First, all property accrued before the 2014 Latta decision should be characterized as separate or community in accordance with the party's intent in acquiring that property. Second, all separate property accrued before any potential retroactive date must be treated as separate property. And joint tenancy property must be divided in accordance with the contributions of the parties, just as it is for opposite sex couples. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you. Before you step aside, do any of my colleagues in Carson City have any questions of Mr. Willock?
Yeah, Chief, this is Justice Kadish. I would like to ask a question.
Please.
So, Mr. Willock, your client and Ms. Klein traveled to Vermont very soon after Vermont started permitting same-sex civil unions, and then traveled to Canada to get married very soon after Canada began allowing marriages, both of which were, I believe, the first or close to the first in our general geographic area where they could easily travel and complete that. So I guess I'm not clear about how we say they went and did a civil union as soon as they could, which was the closest thing to marriage possible at the time, and then went and got married in Canada as soon as they could, but they didn't actually intend to be married. Can you explain that?
Sure. The uncontroverted testimony at trial was that these actions were both taken for political purposes, to try to prevent repeal of the various laws in question. They both had legal training. They both were fully aware that these would have no legal effect in the state of Nevada. And they never took any action, either physically with the assets or on the paperwork when it was legally possible to do so in 2009, to do something to make those actions have a legal effect. These are parties who knew what the legal effect of their actions were. And the legal effects of their actions as to their property was zero. And they lived accordingly. They didn't combine accounts. They didn't combine assets. They did what they did for political purposes only. And it wasn't until Latta in 2014 that they were first put on notice that those actions could have some effect on their property and holdings. And by that time, they were already in litigation against one another.
But Mr. Willock, though, an opposite-sex couple who traveled to Canada in 2003 and got married there while residing in Nevada, all of their property would have been community property going forward unless they did something specifically to change that, wouldn't it?
If they had been an opposite-sex couple, yes, and they would have known at the time that they did what they did that it would have a legal effect. Here, these parties knew exactly the opposite.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of couples who get married who don't know the community property effect of getting married. There's no test on that. So,
that's exactly why I cited the annulment cases and the common law state, common law marriage states. It has to do with the intentions of the parties in doing the acts that they do. In the annulment cases, and I do 10 of these, 20 of these a year. People get married in Las Vegas. They go, they pull a license, they go through a ceremony, they get a certificate, and then they go back to wherever they came from. And then we hear from them a year later, 2 years later, 3 years later, where they say that they were drunk, or they say that they did it just for fun, that they didn't realize it would have an effect in France, or whatever their excuse or story is. And our courts grant annulments all the time. The question is their intention in going through the steps that they went through. And here we have testimony what their intentions were. Their intentions were not to have common property. Their intentions were to make a political statement, a political action, to prevent repeal of statutes in other places, knowing that it would have no legal effect here. So there is a complete distinction based only on the fact that their same-sex couples were retroactively married. And the retroactivity effect can't be overstated. These parties were on no notice whatsoever that anything they were doing would have any legal effect on them until 2014, 2 years after the relationship broke down. And it's only these couples who have this problem with property. Everybody else who did whatever they did, marriage ceremonies, commitment ceremonies, civil unions, whatever, no legal effect if they broke up before 2014. No legal effect that they couldn't fix if they did what they did after 2014. It's only parties in this particular factual timing situation that have this problem. And that's why it's an equal protection problem.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. You have 5 minutes and 30 seconds, Mr. Willock, remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Jones, are you prepared to proceed?
I am, Justice. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. Don Jones appearing on behalf of the respondent. And I do have to agree 100% with Justice Kadish with the question she asked, because that was my lead. My lead was actually more these parties, and it's important to remember that the appellant is a law professor, a well-educated lawyer and professor of law. These parties were in love to the point where they flew across the country as soon as they could to execute legal documents. Exhibit one at the time of trial is a document that speaks for itself, but more importantly, was executed under penalty of perjury, acknowledging that this was their intent. And the intent under the Vermont statute was to create the rights of spouses.
Mr. Jones, so, may I interrupt you? Justice Perrigueri here. I thought I heard Mr. Willock say that it's undisputed that the parties went to Vermont and then subsequently to Canada as a political statement. There was no intent there to create any type of the legally binding union. Can you address that? Maybe I misheard Mr. Willock.
I absolutely can, and I think Mr. Willock took some liberties with the record here. While it was certainly the appellant's testimony that that was her only reason, and you have to remember that in many cases of divorce, as Justice Stiglitz pointed out, a lot of people don't realize that they're getting married and making everything they earn, one half the other spouses, and then suddenly, when it comes time to get divorced and divide their property according to community property law, their intent was suddenly different. But in this case, Gail, the respondent, did not testify that she went there for that reason.
Well, did she contest that? How contested was that issue?
She testified they went there because they were in love, Your Honor.
Okay.
This idea that it was a mutual testimony, and the record speaks for itself. As you know, the brief nor the argument did not include any references to actual testimony where the respondent said, yes, I only went there for a political statement. Indeed, Ms. LaFrance was a very vocal advocate for marriage equality. That is absolutely true. But it doesn't change the fact that there was no mutual agreement that that's the only reason. But more importantly, I don't think it matters. I think you go and you sign a legal document as a lawyer, and another liberty with the record was that the respondent had not started law school at the time of the union. So the idea that she was equally aware of legal rights or not aware of legal rights is not accurate either. But when they signed the document and filed the document, from that day forward, they had the rights of spouses. They had the most rights they possibly could get in the United States. So the idea that they didn't intend that consequence, when you're a lawyer and you're a law professor and you sign under penalty of perjury that this is what we intend to do, you don't get to take that position 17 years later, when the property that was accumulated during the marriage is about to be divided by a court of law. That is not consistent with the application. Otherwise, these things wouldn't matter. Anybody who signed a document could say, well, I only did that for political reasons. I don't believe that that is the precedent that this court wants to create, particularly in a domestic relations matter. Now, the most important act between these parties was, in fact, this partnership agreement, this civil union that they created in Vermont. Because regardless of the unfortunate enactment of the Defense of Marriage Act, and regardless of its appropriate repeal, the parties retained the rights under Vermont law to be spouses, the rights of spouses. And that continued. It continued through the repeal of DOMA. And here's the important part, and there's a comment in the argument that the parties did not get a Nevada domestic partnership. Well, they didn't need to because they already had the rights of spouses. And the one thing I thought about was if this action was brought prior to 2009, if the divorce action started, say, in 2008, prior to Nevada enacting domestic partnerships, there might be a question, what is the Nevada public policy as it pertains to a civil union, because we wouldn't have known prior to that. And as far as full faith and credit is concerned, the court at that point would have had to have determined whether or not Nevada's public policy was consistent with Vermont's. The fortunate thing for this court and for this case is that Nevada passed domestic partnerships in 2009, and this action didn't start until 2014. So we knew what the public policy of the state of Nevada was, and that was to recognize these parties' rights, while not able to marry at the time, to create a legally binding rights of spouses relationship. Now, on the issue of equal protection, this is really problematic, and this is where I actually have testimony for the court from the trial, because this idea that the appellant was deprived of the right to enter into agreements by not knowing she was married until after the repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act is completely contrary to her testimony. It's volume 9, page 1600. Question. This is my cross-examination of the appellant. At no time between August of 2000 and today did a premarital agreement, postmarital agreement, property agreement, or any other type of agreement that would define your rights between you and Gail was ever signed, right? Answer, no, I proposed one on several occasions, but Gail refused. So this idea that this law professor did not know that she could have created a trust, that would have defined the character of the property going into it, that she could have entered into a partnership agreement. Nothing barred two parties from entering into a partnership agreement, which defied their rights and obligations to one another, by entering into any type of agreement that the law would recognize, whether it was based upon a marital or quasi-marital relationship. There was nothing stopping this law professor from doing that and having it done. Cohabitation agreements. Sorry, but these are basic concepts of people who are allegedly not married or allegedly do not know they're married during the course of their 17-year relationship. And the idea that the marriage broke down in 2012, that doesn't matter. What matters is they were divorced by the district court in 2017. So when you look at the testimony of the appellant, you can't buy into any of this equal protection argument. And when you look at her field of expertise and her number of years of experience, you could never believe that she did not know she could enter into these types of agreements, or that she did not know she was creating the rights of spouses. I mean, if you, depending on your recall of the record, you'll recall that the appellant also sought to have the union annulled based upon alleged fraud, because in 2012, respondent changed her personality. Obviously, the court disregarded that argument and disregarded the argument that she didn't know the legal effect of what she was signing, because no court could ever accept that a woman of this intelligence and experience in the law would not understand that. On the issue of the division of property and the comment regarding the alleged $1 million as represented by exhibits that are referenced, I believe, on page 15 of appellant's brief, those exhibits show a handful of accounts that existed as of 2000, year 2000. They also show some account statements as of 2003. A majority of the accounts in question did not exist at the time of trial. And one of the reasons the court was very careful on the issue of tracing is because there was a giant gap in documentation. And the law on tracing is very clear. If you're going to make a claim regarding your separate property, you've got to be able to, a separate property contribution to otherwise marital or community property, you've got to be very careful to provide a very specific tracing. And obviously, in the brief, you saw a reference to the exclusion of appellant's expert at the time of trial. Basically, the court recognized, because the later submitted expert report was not submitted timely, it was excluded by the discovery commissioner, and that was upheld by the trial judge. So they attempted to address the first and timely produced expert report, which only went back to 2003. Now, the court granted summary judgment on the year 2000 as the beginning of the marital relationship, or as the beginning of the rights of spouses. So the district court, rightfully, in looking at a report that only went back to 2003 as the only possible report, concluded, and also based upon the fact that there was a 2.5 year, in some cases, and a greater period of time of gap in statements to establish a tracing, but there was no way for the appellant to prove whether or not the accounts that existed at the time of marriage were liquidated, whether they were commingled with community property, which would have started as of August of 2020, whether they were consumed by the parties based upon their lifestyle. And so because there was no tracing linking the premarital accounts to anything that existed at the time of trial, the court properly determined that the appellant could not meet her burden to establish that these accounts now represent the accounts that existed 17 years prior. On the issue
counsel,
of the house...
Counsel, excuse me, this is Justice Hardesty. Could you clarify something for me?
Yes.
Was the property division that was undertaken in this case pursuant to Vermont law or Nevada law?
I believe that the court applied Nevada law, Your Honor.
And so how could the court apply Nevada law to the division of property
that is predicated on a Vermont civil union. Why I don't see in the record where Judge Steele or Judge Ames, Judge Sullivan, any of them evaluated the effect of the Vermont statute that rejected the equating of the civil union to a marriage. So on what grounds did the divorce court in Nevada separate the property using Nevada law rather than the civil union statutes in Vermont?
Well, because the civil union statutes give the parties the rights of spouses. And even in Vermont, the accumulation of property during the relationship would result in what would otherwise be an equal division. So I don't think that the district court believed it made a difference. That issue was never raised, obviously, by either party at the trial court level, as to whether or not there would be a difference in the application of Vermont law versus Nevada law. But I believe Mr. Willick argued that the law of the state where the parties are domiciled would control. And that's why I assumed that the court applied Nevada law, though the decision did not come right out and say that as it pertains to the division of property, it is applying Nevada law. Now, on this issue of property and the issue that it was raised regarding the award of property, basically...
Well, excuse me if I may. The finding on page 4 in the middle of the order says that the court further orders that the party's property, other than what is already stated as separate, appears to be community property. That says to me that the district court is applying a community property concept to a Vermont civil union, correct?
I agree.
What's the legal basis for doing that? How we have
this would be Nevada was the jurisdiction in which the parties resided, where the parties accumulated, I believe, all, if not a majority, of the property that was at issue, other than potentially the claimed property that existed at the time of the civil union.
But the property that was acquired in the context of their civil union. They were never married in Nevada. The marriage in Canada, why wouldn't that be recognized? And then the property divided pursuant to the marriage in Canada rather than the civil union in Vermont.
Well, if this court were to apply the Vermont equivalent, the Nevada domestic partnership statute, it would divide property as community property.
How do we do that, though? They didn't qualify for a Nevada domestic partnership. This is the thing that's troubling to me, Mr. Jones. The trial courts here said, we're basing everything for a start date from the Vermont Civil Union. That the purpose of that union was exactly what was stated. It was a Vermont civil union. And nothing changed after that other than the Canadian marriage, which wasn't really evaluated, or the effect of it wasn't evaluated. So how do you get from a Vermont civil union to dividing property under Nevada community property law? Where's the connection?
Well, I mean, I suppose it would be exactly as if the parties were married in a different jurisdiction that wasn't a community property jurisdiction and divorced in the state of Nevada. I mean, it gives the rights of spouses. So Nevada district courts would always apply Nevada law to a division of property in a community property basis if the parties were being divorced here, particularly when their entire relationship was as domiciles of the state of Nevada, where the vast majority of the community property was accumulated.
Well, how can you say that community property was accumulated? There's no basis for a conclusion that these people acquired community property at any time.
Well, the parties acquired rights of spouses, and they were spouses residing in the state of Nevada. That's how they accumulated community property.
And the basis for that statement is the statutes in Vermont?
That and the statutes of the state of Nevada.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, on the issue of the relief sought on the property, it almost seems like the relief requested is for them to get to have a new day at trial, saying, okay, we didn't present the necessary evidence to meet our burden on the tracing. We'd like another shot at it. I don't believe that that's what this court is for. There was no Rule 52 or Rule 59 motion filed, and all of the issues relating to the division of property are being raised for the first time on appeal, which, I mean, it's well established that that's not permitted. But on the issue of the house, they offered no evidence or testimony that would indicate that it would be anything other than an equal division of the house, regardless of whether it was in joint tenancy or held as community property. There was no representation that this down payment came from an account solely in my name, but even if it did, there was no evidence, even if there were such testimony, which there wasn't, there was no evidence to establish that the money in whatever account it came from wasn't full of property that was acquired after the parties acquired the rights of spouses. So the idea, and because it was acquired during the union, when they had rights of spouses, it's presumed to be community property or marital property. But again, they didn't present any evidence that would trace the source of the money going into that house. And I believe the argument was even made that the parties owned a joint tenancy home in Florida, and I believe the testimony is that it was rolled into the Nevada. So there was no testimony offered as to the source of the purchase of the Florida property. So if they have no evidence to support the fact that they should have been allowed to trace it out, that goes back to the theory that they're asking for a new day in trial, which they had an opportunity to do with a post-trial motion, but did not take it. In conclusion, there was no abuse of discretion. There was either substantial evidence to base the decision upon, or there was an absence of evidence on the part of the appellant when it was her burden to try to trace her separate property to what would clearly be property accumulated by the parties during their rights of spouses. The equal protection argument is belied by the appellant's own testimony, the fact that the parties had wills naming each other as beneficiaries. The only document that existed that could have, if I may, Your Honor, have a few more minutes based upon the question.
You should wrap up.
I was wrapping up, but the only document that was discussed at trial that the parties executed during their union was a will in which Ms. LaFrance made Gail Klein her primary beneficiary of her entire estate. So if you want to talk about intent, I don't know that you can get better evidence of intent than that document and the fact that this law professor signed these documents under oath in Vermont in August of 2000. Thank you very much.
Justice Pickering.
Thank you.
Chief?
Yes.
I would like to have the liberty of a comment briefly, if I may. I had the feeling that it sounded like Mr. Jones and I were shouting at each other, and I want to extend an apology if it seemed like that was the case. I'm trying to talk through a mask. I'm not sure whether he can hear me. And I want to make clear, Mr. Jones, I'm truly not trying to shout at you. I just wasn't sure you were able to hear what I was saying. And I know you're speaking loudly too, and I just want to express my apologies if it came across that way.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I think the technology is not perfect, and my voice has never been accused of not carrying even across the internet. So I apologize to my tone.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Willock, you have 5.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Starting with the point of the questioning, which brings us back to Braddock and where property was actually accumulated. While I appreciate Mr. Jones' statement, that is not what the record shows. The unrefuted record shows that Mary was working as an attorney and a professor in D.C., Virginia, and Florida for decades before she ever met Gail. Her retirement accounts were started decades before she met Gail. These parties first met in 1992, at which time substantial retirement benefits already existed. They didn't begin to date or cohabit until 95, and they didn't move to Nevada until 96. So there's 20 years of retirement benefits in Mary's name that, of course, still existed at the date of divorce. Frankly, the tap dance about a gap in documentation is simply not valid. It's one of the reasons this is an equal protection case. In every opposite sex case that we see, the district court judge says, I order that the separate and community property interests in the retirement fund be divided in accordance with Gemma and Fondi. Do a quadro and figure it out. We do that literally every day in our Quadromasters division. The only thing that's different between this case and those cases is that this is the same-sex couple case. Beadle offered to provide a complete tracing of every asset, and he was dismissed from being allowed to do so. It is inherently unfair to say that the evidence doesn't support a particular division when it's not required in an opposite-sex case, and it's offered and refused. There was no finding as to any burden. As to the house, Mary testified that it was her money that went into it and that she contributed most of it. The judge just didn't care about that testimony. So it brings us back to Braddock. The law of the place where all of the assets in question were accumulated at the entire time that the assets were accumulated is that it was the separate property of the parties. And it's not like there is no documentation. Every single one of these retirement accounts, bank accounts, parcels of real estate, they all had documentation.
Mr. Willick, this is Justice Hardesty. I apologize for interrupting you, but I do have a question I think it's important to follow up on from Mr. Jones' observations. My understanding of the record is that the expert report offered by the appellant in this case was excluded because of a discovery problem, not because of, and as a consequence, the tracing was could not be accomplished earlier than 2003. Isn't that the case?
Not really. There were two reports from Mr. Beadle. One was denied from admission as irrelevant, and the other was denied as untimely. Taking them one at a time, the irrelevant report traced all of Mary's separate property from the time of the Canadian marriage ceremony. Judge Harder made the error of saying that nobody could do any discovery because a writ petition was pending in this court. That legal error prevented the supplementation of the report for the extra 7 months that went by until the actual trial date. So there was no opportunity to actually do the tracing from the earlier potential date. However, there was an offer of proof saying that the value of the separate property was less in 2003 than it had been in 2000. So the court had before it unrefuted testimony that the minimum value was what's set forth in the footnote in the opening brief, 1,200,000+, whatever that number is. Mm-hmm. There is no contrary testimony. And the evidence that was admitted establishes those values as of those dates. So, no, there is no lawful excuse for treating pre-civil union property as anything other than separate property. It just couldn't be. And there's been some discussion about the effect of the Nevada domestic partnership law in 2009, and submit that this is a Sherlock Holmes dog that didn't bark situation. When Nevada passed its domestic partnership law, it required if anybody had a civil union from anywhere else to actually make it have lawful effect, they were required to register it. They didn't. They consciously chose not to. Two people with legal training in 2009 chose not to. They both testified that they never wanted to co-own property, and they never even discussed doing so in all the years that they were accumulating property. So, no, I respectfully submit that the evidence of intent is clear. The district court just didn't care about that intention. The retirement accounts clearly existed.
Could you address my question, if the chief will permit it? I asked Mr. Jones how it is that the district court established a civil union and then did not divide the property in accordance with Vermont statutes, but rather divided it as community property in Nevada. Is that an assignment of error that you raise? I didn't see that.
I see that my time has expired. May I answer the question?
Yes, sir.
To answer your question, Justice Hardesty, no, it was not raised as a specific assignment of error, but the trial, the ruling that you were reading from, clearly, it just didn't care. It didn't set the start date for property as of the date of the Vermont Civil Union or the date of the Canadian marriage ceremony, and it didn't care about Vermont law. It simply said that all assets that Mary had ever owned in her entire life would be divided with Gail equally as community property, which is indefensible under any version of Nevada law or the law of any other state.
But, Chief, if I may, just a follow-up.
Yes, Mr. Justice Perigary.
Yeah, Mr. Willick, in looking at the order itself, the Florida retirement account was actually carved out as separate property. Is that right, or was that by agreement?
No, no, it wasn't by agreement. There were multiple Florida retirement accounts.
Okay.
The only one that the district court chose to treat as separate property was one account in Gail's name that she testified she made no contributions to during the course of the party's relationship. All of the other accounts, they clearly existed, but there were contributions continuing to be made to them. This court said in Walsh and in Forrest and in a host of other cases going back to the early 80s that when you have a retirement account, which is partially before a marriage, even if you're going to deem one of these things a marriage, and partially after, that you are required to apportion the portions of it in accordance with the time rule. That's what Gemma says, Fondi, Certic, Wolf. This court has said that over and over and over again.
Well, perhaps the order is a little ambiguous to me. It seems that you're saying there's numerous accounts going back prior to 2000 and when they lived in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. All right, and then there's one that's carved out that somehow it's a separate interest account only.
Yes, the district court judge didn't care about the time rule. He simply said that if any contribution had been made to any retirement account any time during the party's relationship with one another, it became community property and had to be equally divided between them.
Even prior to Vermont in 2000?
Oh, yes, 25 years.
Yeah, okay.
Prior to Vermont.
Got it. That was my question. You answered. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both counsel for their briefs and oral arguments. We will be in recess briefly and return to the bench at 2:00. Thank you. The case will be under submission.